Thank you for the invitation. Thank you for being here. It brings me back many years when I was attending McGill, so it's always a pleasure to come back and haunt these places. Before I start, I would like to dedicate this evening to Jean Léopold Dominique, who was assassinated exactly 6 years ago, and whose work has been really key in bringing about, accompanying the struggle of the Haitian people for democracy. One of the reasons that brings me here today is that a bit more than 2 years ago, a regime change was imposed on the Haitian people, and it was imposed in your name, since the Canadian government, which pretends to represent you, which supposedly you have put in power, was involved in the preparation of the coup, in its execution, and in its aftermath. I'm also here because Haiti and the Haitian people are probably one of the most misrepresented to international public opinion, including to its natural sister nation in the Caribbean. Indeed, it has been a much maligned country and people. And it is this disinformation campaign that this tour and the work of Chan aims to defeat, because only when you don't have the correct opinion can your government undertake under your name a policy so disastrous for the Haitian people and disastrous for the image of Canada as Canadian policy toward Haiti has been in the last 3 years. And all of that, this operation for which they have invented a new name, regime change, when in fact it is your old-fashioned coup d'etat, this was undertook supposedly to teach the Haitian people about the value of democracy. I'll tell you just an anecdote about how much the Haitian people needs to be taught about democracy. I suppose you've seen the images of last February 7th, when tens of thousands of people took to the street to vote despite all the obstacles that had been laid in their way to the ballot box, despite the fact that with the help of Canadian funds, the process itself had been rigged to precisely hold back the very majority of Haitian people. But you haven't seen the 500,000 people who had taken to the street of Port-au-Prince just prior, two years prior to the date on February 7, 2004, to say 5 years. That is the length of a presidential mandate. This is what we voted for our president to do his 5 years, and after that for us to go back to the ballot. So we do not agree with any kind of regime change. But these images were kept from world public opinion. But these are collective manifestation of the will of the Haitian people to conquer democracy. But I'll tell you a little anecdote that involves one person. That was in December 1990, a few days before the first democratic election in Haiti that would bring Jean-Bertrand Aristide to power. On February 5th, during a rally that President Aristide held in Pétionville above Port-au-Prince, somebody, a hired killer, lobbed a grenade into the crowd. Six people were killed, and quite a large number were terribly hurt by the shrapnel from the grenade. And on the next day, I accompanied then-candidate Aristide to the General Hospital to visit the wounded. And as he came to a man who had lost two legs in the incident, that man told him, "President, you know what worries me the most is that in that melee yesterday, I lost my voting card. Could you please help me get another one so that I can vote?" So this, in a nutshell, is how much Haitians value democracy, how much they value the vote as a way for people to decide on who should lead the country. But not only that, I think the vote exists in countries like Canada, even though we'll see that it has been emptied of much of its signification in a democracy. But yet, democracy and the democracy that they wanted to impose on the Haitian people is one in which precisely citizens are asked to go to the ballot every now and then like sheep, and then that's all the participation that is expected of them and allowed to them in the decision-making process that will affect their own life. And then the people are supposed to leave all power to the represented, their representative that had been elected through that process. The Haitian people did not want that version of democracy. They wanted one in which they would be empowered as a majority, as full citizens, every day of the year. And before the vote, during the vote, and after the vote. That's what they wanted. In other words, they were telling the world again about the true meaning of words. Back in 1791, after the French Revolution has supposedly proclaimed the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Man, it were Haitian slaves who pointed out that the true meaning of universal meant everybody, not white people. It meant everybody. And the Haitian people stood up as one man or one person and started the only successful slave revolution in the history of the world. And by doing so, by paying the price that was demanded of them, the price in blood, the price in suffering, in 1794, they made freedom a universal right of man. And now, 200 years later, Haiti, rather than being the pitiful case that people are sometimes considering to throw pity at, I submit that the Haitian people are again showing the way, showing that democracy involves the empowerment of every citizen, regardless of their income, regardless of how privileged they were to go to school or not. Because you cannot have a too tired democracy. You cannot have classes of citizens. That's what the Haitian people have been fighting for. And that's why I say that we in Canada, rather than see our solidarity with Haiti, rather than see whatever interest we develop toward Haiti as something we do for the sake of the Haitian people only, we should see it also as something we do for our own sake. We might learn a few things about the failings of our own democracy here by seeing how the Haitian people are marching, are demonstrating, are voting for the real stuff. Because let's be frank, what percentage of the population actually picks the government of Canada? More and more people are disaffected. And yet, they're going to have a government that's going to rule over their life. Yet, they've become totally disaffected toward the process. And not only that, I submit to you that a vast portion of the population has been, in fact, disempowered by its limited access to crucial information, has been disempowered by the fact that TV, which should have been a tool of enlightenment, is used as a tool to anesthetize the majority of young people in this country. You know, I come here, I see that my kids, they have access to 100 channels, but it's, you know, once in a blue moon that I can actually tune into a program that might give me information that is really important for me. All you have is the equivalent, you know, Marx used to say that religion was the opium of the people. But now, in the 21st century, it's TV that is the opium of the people. So, as things go in this democracy, and you by no means alone, in the States it's probably even worse, in Europe it's getting to be like that, a small portion of people actually get to vote. And after they vote, an even smaller club actually gets to decide on what policies are going to be applied at home, relative to health care program, relative to child care program, relative to social solidarity programs. A small number of select people sit down, both in government and in the private sector, and decide what kind of economic development, what policy is going to be applied in the relationship of Canada with other countries, what jobs would be relocated in other countries that happen to have oppressive government who are pushing the wage down, pushing the work conditions down, and ending up creating misery in these countries and creating misery here. I wonder how well is the textile industry, for example, working in Canada. So you see, decisions are being taken in your name, affecting your life, affecting how Canada is perceived. Canada and Canadians, I must say, are perceived in the world, and yet you don't have a say in them. You're not even aware of them, usually. You know, you end up being sent to Afghanistan, tomorrow to Iran, and nobody ever asked you whether or not you agree to the policy or its objective. So I think that the whole idea of trying to teach Haitian about democracy, about its value, falls flat on its face. Besides, we've never seen democracy being exported in any country of the world. And I do think that the more Canada is going to try and export democracy, the less there's going to be in this country. Another pernicious concept that has been evoked for this Canadian intervention in Haiti is responsibility to protect. I think we live in the era of spin doctors. They're great at coining new words to describe the same old bull. Used to be a massacre of civilians. It's turned into collateral damage. You know, it's a nice, clean word. It does not speak about blood and guts and dismembered kids and women and old people and non-combatants in general. It's collateral damage. It's been neutralized as a word. I was mentioning coup d'etat or violation of the right to self-determination. It's turned into regime change. And now we have that responsibility to protect. Supposedly, there are some failed states. And as we speak, I think Canada has a list of 50 countries that it deems as failed state, in which they would have the right to intervene and bring in stability, respect for human rights, etc., etc. It looks and sounds nice, and it appeals to people who are in good faith, who feel generosity, solidarity, people who are moved sometimes by the terrible image that are beamed into their living room from far corners of the world, and they say, yes, we have a responsibility to protect. And we do have a responsibility to protect because we are one human family. But the doctrine that is being sold to you by the powerful of the world under that responsibility to protect, it's nothing but a new way to repackage the white man's burden. This idea that it was the white man's responsibility to go to every corner of the world and spread civilization. And if you take that map drawn by Canada, including 50 countries in which Canada would feel free to go and protect. And if you look at the list that the US has, that's probably more than 50, you will see that this map just about covers the very same country that, beginning in the time of colonialism, have been the object of the solicitude of the white man's burden. They are precisely the countries that have been exploited, that have been left in a terrible mess by the very same power that now pretend they're going to protect them. So you can see how much hogwash it is, how much arrogance, how much racism is and are much very down-to-earth economic greed lies behind these two beautiful words, responsibility and protect. This is nothing but an attempt at hoodwinking you into buying into something that eventually is going to turn against you. So that's why I say we do have a responsibility to protect, the same way we have to build a transnational community of real people, a transnational community of brotherhood to oppose to the globalization as seen by the powerful of the world. If we do not realize that globalization is a fact today, but there has to be at least two versions of it, a globalization of oppression or a globalization of solidarity. And we must develop that global solidarity. We can no longer think in strictly national terms. We cannot say what's happening in Haiti does not in any way concerns me because the country is far away, the people are a different color, or their income cannot even start to compare to mine. You'll see either through solidarity or through the suffering that is going to be imposed upon you from things happening in Afghanistan, then truly you belong to a global village. Now, is it one to be ruled by the select few, or is it one into which solidarity will reign? This is for you to decide. Sorry. But there are other reasons, I think, to look at Haiti and try to learn a few things from that people that's been described always as the poorest in the Western Hemisphere. Because if Haitians are poor, when you count wealth only in material terms, when you believe that we are what we own, they are not poor when you look at their resilience, at the richness of their culture, at their sense of identity. And because of that resilience, because of that creativity, Haitians have been masters at managing scarcity. I don't think we here could live 2 days with what resources Haitians are managing. And I think also that given the type of development seen only as increased production and productivity, I do think that if we stick to this type of development, if we keep on that consumption binge into which we've been blindly led, our future is definitely one that will be marked at some point by scarcity that we will have to manage. So I think that Haitians are also choosing a type or development rather than have it imposed upon them. Because really, I don't want to act like a prophet, but if you look at what is happening in China, if you look at what is happening in India, you will see that there is a very real possibility that the Chinese, who could never bring the capitalist system down by opposing it will probably bring it down by pushing it to its extreme conclusion by actually joining capitalism. You see, China's economy and India's economy are practically in meltdown mode. So if the American dream, if the Canadian dream becomes the norm, you're going to have not 300 million North Americans pursuing that dream, you're going to have 2.5 billion people going after that so-called, you know, epitome of civilization. This is what happiness looks like, then we're going to have it. All of us are going to have 3 color TV and 5 cars. And of course, we do know that the amount of oil is finite, the amount of copper, the amount of iron ore, etc., etc. So we are heading for a meltdown. And we better get ready for it. If we can't avoid it, I think, you know, we should start preparing for it. And maybe by preparing for it, we might avoid it. I think also a notion that Haitians in the last 20 years have been exposing, or if you want, proving so clearly, is that democracy is not a place or a club into which you buy, and once you're there, you can relax and put your democracy on cruise control and start dozing off at the wheel. Democracy is a process. And a process is like a seed. You know, once you put a seed in the ground, you just don't turn your back on it. You got to water it. You got to remove, you know, whatever vegetation, you know, that might strangle it.
Weed.
And you have to water it. Either you will water it with your sweat, and it will grow, and it will sprout, or you might have to water it with your blood if you let its decay go on too far. And I do think that the so-called old democracy that exists in the G8 countries need some new blood. They need some new direction, and it won't be coming from within. I see it happening from without. I see it happening in countries like Venezuela, Bolivia, Haiti, possibly in Mexico, and it happens to come from the very people that we consider the most destitute, the very people that we consider sometimes beyond saving. And I come to one question that you will probably ask me, because it's been asked of me every time I've given a talk. But why would Canada, the US, France get involved in Haiti? What is there to justify the fact that since 1915, the US have sent their troops in Haiti 3 times? What is there to justify that France would send, France, which is half a world away from Haiti, would send its troops to Haiti on February 29, 2004, to effect a regime change? What is there for Canada, who's been known as a benevolent giant, to actually send his special forces to take the airport so that the Americans and the French could come. And it is an answer that is not as easy as it is for Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, or Venezuela, or Congo. Haiti is not known for having a lot of wealth in its soil. It might be possible that we have, but really the evidence for that has not been forthcoming. But, and that's why I say also that rather than being the poorest country in the world, Haiti might actually be one of the richest, because the true wealth of a country is not in its belly, in its soil. It is not what is under the soil, but what is over the soil, that is the people of that country. You know, we cannot be thinking like Mr. Oppenheimer, who thinks the value of a country resides in the diamond. We cannot be thinking like Mr. Rockefeller and think that the value of the country resides in as much oil there is deep in the earth. The greatest wealth of a country is what is above it, the population of that country. And the U.S., for one, since 1915, have considered Haiti as a reservoir of cheap labor. In and around 1915, the U.S. occupied Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, Dominican Republic, Honduras. And for each country, they ascribe a role to it. Cuba and the Dominican Republic were to be the place to develop large sugarcane plantation, and Haiti would furnish the workers to go and cut the cane in this American-owned large plantation. And that is actually what happened, as is well known. There is still in the Dominican Republic large number of Haitians that go cut the sugar cane there. And there has been also in Cuba since around 1915 a large movement of Haitian workers that went to cut the cane there. You don't hear about these because Castro made them full Cuban citizens after his coming to power. So Haiti is still a potential reservoir of cheap labor. And it is that not only for American-owned company, but also for Canadian-owned company. So there is one reason why Canada and the U.S. would want in Haiti a government that does not have does not rally its population, but rather force upon that population condition that will make it cheaper for foreign company to exploit it. But there is also another reason, and I think Canada has benefited a lot from the exodus from Haiti of all the cadres that were grown in Haiti, very often educated in Haiti, and you find this finished product emigrating to Canada, where the demand for now no longer for untrained workers, but the demand for engineers, for doctors, for computer expert and manager, is growing, and these do not cost Canada much to produce because they are produced in Haiti. But also, You have to look at the value of symbols. We tend to think that only something we can hold that you find quoted, you know, in the Wall Street Journal have values. But symbols also have values. In 1804, when Haiti defeated both colonialism, racism, and slavery, Haiti was the object of the hostility of the most powerful country of the world, Spain, the US, England, and France, because it was showing a way that was detrimental to the interests of these powers. Cuba, for example, never actually represented a threat to the US. Yes, we've seen how Cuba has been interfered with, blockaded since about 1962 by the US, because it represented a symbol, an example, a potential model. And I say that today again, Haiti is this symbol. The symbol that no matter how poor people are, no matter how illiterate they've been kept by the minority which rules them locally or dominates them from abroad, these people can actually fight for democracy and actually build their democracy. And as they build their democracy, they're strengthening their right to self-determination, their right to pick their own course. And the message that the Haitian people is passing on, and that the powerful are trying to quench, is that if we can do it, then you can do it. This message is as powerful today as the cry of freedom of Haiti back in 1804. And that's reason enough to try, when the Haitian people make their decision, as they made four times, that make the decision to pick their leadership on based on the principle of one citizen, one vote, to pick an agenda of social justice, an agenda of inclusion, then when the Haitian people make that choice, some want to change the rule of the game, you know. Once they see that they're losing that game, now they want to change the rule of the game. They say that the Haitian people not only have to vote freely, supposedly, but more specially, they have to vote right. That is, they have to pick leaders that are agreeable to Canadian interests, that are agreeable to American foreign policy, and this the Haitian people don't accept. They will never accept it, and it is time to come to terms with that. The Haitian people were unstoppable in 1791, when they were reaching out toward freedom. Napoleon sent his army at them. England did, Spain did, and in the end, they were all vanquished by the Haitian people. Today, the Haitian people are on the march toward true democracy. And they've been trying to stop it, but they will not be able to do so. They might impose suffering on the people. They might raise the cost of democracy for us. Maybe even they will make us pay the same price that we paid for freedom. A third of the population died in the War of Independence. But the Haitian people will not be stopped. So it is time for Canada, and I hope the Canadian people get the message from the Haitian people. It is time that the Canadian government starts engaging the Haitian people as a true free nation. And whatever help the Canadian people want to extend to Haiti must, from now on, go through the elected leadership of Haiti, not go through de facto regimes imposed from abroad, nor through NGOs that are not truly NGOs because all their funds come from foreign government. They are foreign agents, they are no NGOs. And I hope also that the Haitian elite, that tiny portion of the Haitian population, 5% controlling 60% of the national wealth, while 80% of the population lives in poverty, but is nevertheless irrepressibly human, I hope this elite understand also that the time of apartheid is over. It's time to exchange privileges for minority rights. If these local elites and countries like Canada get the message, I do think that there is a lot of hope for Haiti, and I do think that the Haitian people again will be a beacon in the world just like they had been 200 years ago. And now I'm open to your question. Thank you.